However, it was a big enough group so that I couldn't expect to have a close watch on everything, because there are just too many people doing too many different things. And then when I moved to the next level, which was called executive director, you know, one step below vice president, then the other, it was not only the chemical research, but there was the metallurgical research and all the materials work, ceramics and everything else. And so as the organization got bigger and bigger, I knew less and less about more and more different things. and that, when I became vice president of research, then that really was the case, because I had that computer science and I had systems engineering and mathematics and behavioral sciences and some economics research and a whole lot of things. And then I really had to.
I've always been curious, when you get to that level, and you, as a scientist yourself, and you get further and further removed from really understanding the nitty gritty of what's going on, how do you feel about that? Do you feel?
I told you I already expressed a preference for the management. It's not because I wanted to wield power or something, but I'd go over to the cafeteria and, by choice, not eat where the people who were, let's say, also the vice president of something or other would eat. I'd rather go out in the cafeteria and look around and see a familiar face of somebody in there and sit down and ask them about, what are you up to, and talk to them. And then I got a little big bang out of talking in a very informal way and with people, and they, I think, recognized that I was genuinely interested in what they were doing, and they could say anything to it. They could complain or badger me about anything or tell me what they were doing, and it was so I could feel a connection with what the place was all about. But I was not in an executive dining room. I was in the cafeteria and looking for anybody that looked familiar. And I learned a whole lot from them, and it was a good way to get the information about what's going on.
Sure.
And so I enjoyed that too, because it did give me contact with so many different things, and so much of it was new to me, the computer science, for example, and operations research and all these things. Well, shoot, I was learning all about the things that were the wave of the future, as well as, in other words, I wasn't, at this point, I wasn't locked in as a chemist. I'd say, though, that as a chemist, and maybe I could contrast this to the mathematicians and the physicists, to their disadvantage, a chemist is used to messy, untidy situations, complexity. The physicist wants to reduce things to a simple system which he can solve exactly. And a mathematician has a mathematical purity about his thinking. But a chemist is much more ready to accept complexity and so forth, and somewhat untidy solutions to things, but they may be the best you can do, and you try to work your way up from that. So felt that a chemist had something to bring to the broad range of activities that we had. As a matter of fact, my predecessor as vice president of research was a chemist, and he was very well known, Bill Baker.
Oh, sure, sure.
And Bill Baker had been vice president of research for 18 years, and then on top of, so for something like 27, 28 years, they had a chemist from Princeton in charge. First Bill Baker, and then myself. There were occasional complaints about the chemist having taken over in a place, in a laboratory that was not a chemical company, but that was, I never felt that I was handicapped in this, but it meant that I was continually challenged to learn new fields and to learn what it was about. And some of the things that I was most interested in when I was vice president of research, they might have been raw material. For example, the optical fiber communication systems. That was probably, when I was vice president, was the thing I pushed hardest and which I came to pass as, and came to fruition. And I was proud of it because I was really ready to pour any resources into the into that. I hate to think how much money we spent on it, but nobody ever asked me to account for it. And we poured money into it, and because I was absolutely convinced that it was going to be the whole system of the future, and the electrical engineers, systems engineers who were working on it, and so forth. And I had set up a group effort on the optical fibers to purify those, and gotten the Corning Company in, talked them into putting in an effort. But it was, you can see in the fibers, that wasn't all that far removed from my previous experience with silicon, so the materials were coming in. But I had to know, why are we doing all of this, and why? It was very simple, but it seemed to me perfectly obvious that optical fibers would take over, and it's come out just that way.
Yes.
I think I probably, well, as a rough guess, and those were earlier dollars, I'm sure that in the research budget I must have spent $100 million on the on the optical fiber effort. Shoot, they got it all back in the first year. I mean, the telephone company, that was one of the things about working for a company that had worked with big big numbers.
This flexibility, this freedom we talked about earlier, did you still have that as you moved up the management this management level?
Yes, I really did. The system there, I really had the freedom. I mean, people were more aware, up the ladder were more aware of what was happening and so on. But I had the freedom to, well, we had certain responsibilities we had to discharge. For example, when I was chemical director, and we were responsible for the specifications for the polyethylene that was going to be used in insulation and so forth. Well, I had to make sure that we did the job and did it right. And that wasn't our, just because we chose to do it, it was because somebody had to do it, and we had that responsibility. We had a number of assigned responsibilities that were recognized. We specified the materials that the Western Electric Company bought. And they might negotiate with several chemical companies and so forth, but it was to our specifications. But when we got, when I was vice president of research, for example, I decided that the computer science was the one thing we really had to start pushing. And so even when they put on a hiring freeze, I told the computer scientists, you hire anybody that's really good that comes along, and I'll find some way or other to cover it. It was a big enough organization, so nobody knew exactly what we were doing. So there was still plenty of freedom to do things, but you couldn't take the whole organization and say, well, we don't need any more metallurgists, just let's make them all computer scientists. You know, they don't turn into you, and if you're only hiring at a modest rate, it takes years to change the emphasis of the organization. But I could push it in certain directions by controlling the hiring. I'd get complaints from the people who I didn't give slots to, but that's the way it would work. So it was my judgment that really, but it was a reflection of the whole environment of what the Bell Labs engineering organizations were doing. I'm sure you know, it's an R&D organization, Bell Labs. It was. And research, which I had close to 1,500 people, and most of the scientific staff were PhDs. But it was only 15% of Bell Labs. The rest of it was all development. And they were specifying the equipment, designing and specifying the equipment that Western Electric would manufacture and deliver to the telephone companies. The only people that had the freedoms that we had were ourselves. We had not total freedom, but pretty close to it, compared to what I saw in other industrial research laboratories. We were in clover. We were, and but again, it was the same thing. It was, as I said earlier, they give you the freedom, and it's and you can produce. The attitude of the AT&T company and the Bell Labs management was, okay, you had a great year this year, so we'll give you all the money that you had this before. See if you can do it again next year. I mean, you have a great year. You, what you really need to do is to keep producing year after year great new things. Mm-hmm. And as long as you're producing, fine.
You took an early retirement.
Oh, yes.
61, not 61, but 82.
Yeah,
I think.
Actually, it was 81. It's the end of 81. I went out of the job the rest of the time. I was cleaning out my desk or having retirement parties or something. I left in, actually, in early 82. There was accumulated vacation and so forth. Well, I'd always thought that, you know, I might have burned myself out at that point. I was very close to the antitrust action because I had the patent organization. I had about 80-some lawyers in my patent organization. And they were patent attorneys. Well, it turned out that for the various legal actions, antitrust and so forth, many of the questions about things that we were doing and the complaints about us revolved around rather esoteric technical questions. And the lawyer that was the most lawyers didn't know anything about these things. But you could take a patent attorney. Well, he couldn't go into court and argue antitrust. He was the guy that could explain the technical reasons why you did certain things. So we were heavily involved. In the last couple of years there, I spent an awful lot of my time on antitrust with the patent attorneys that I had assigned to the this thing. But then the consent decree came along, and the Bell system was going to be broken up on the 1st of January 1984. And I said, I'm not going to be here then, because I've worked too hard to build, to maintain. I didn't start from scratch, but to build on the ideas of my predecessors and to do everything to ensure the quality of this organization. I'm not going to stay here. I said, there's no way that it isn't going to be broken up in time. It's going to be only an empty shell of its former self. I'm not going to be here. Mm-hmm. So I decided then and there, when the consent decree was announced, that I was going to retire early. And I did, a couple of years before then. Because it just wasn't attractive to take apart something that, you know, when you've been deciding how you're going to build this research organization. Now, the development people may have been less frightened by this because they're still going to be developing equipment and so forth. They may have more pressures to on schedules or to listen to the salesman. But our freedoms, as we'd had them, shoot, that isn't going to survive in the long run. It's going to have to be scaled back. So I said, well, I only live once. I'm going to retire early. So I did retire early. Found myself for some years working harder than I first two or three years. I didn't think I was going to consult or anything, but I had a lot of friends in, partly because of this freedom of interaction with other organizations, other companies. Partly because I'd been active in the Industrial Research Institute, I'd been president of it, the IRI. And various people I knew who were typically the vice president of research at other companies, they approached me. And I hadn't gone around looking for any consulting, but I started getting consulting, and then I was invited to join boards and so forth. And the first 3 or 4 years, I remember I counted up one time. I said, my wife said, you're doing an awful lot of traveling. So I looked at my calendar, and I had made 36 round trips from the West Coast to the East Coast in the course of one calendar year. What time did I see that plane?
Train? 4:30.
4:30.
4:33 at least.
Yeah, that's what I said.
It's 3:30 now.
Yeah, well, it's not going to take an hour to get there, but no, I want to, and I'm sure they'll have a taxi down there. And it really, they can drive it in 15 or 20 minutes, but I have to buy the ticket. So we probably... Are you going to go to the railroad station now, too?
Well, I am, but we'll see. I have to clean this up and check out. So if I don't go with you, why, I'll just go up later.
Yeah. Well, so. I ought to leave at 10 or 5.
Okay.
5 of.
All right. Good. All right. I'll watch and make sure.
Yeah, and I couldn't imagine what would take this much time. But it seems to me that you're clever keeping me talking. I've been spouting off about a whole lot of things.
Oh, and, it's been great.
And I don't know whether we've even begun to cover the all the topics that you might have wanted to ask. But I consider that I've been very fortunate. You know, I've worked at a great place. Now I look back on it, I can't imagine having worked at any institution that I had a greater affection for than Bell Labs. Mm-hmm. It was a great place to be. You know, exciting people, they were smart, and they were doing exciting things. And I enjoyed the management thing. When I wasn't that I disliked science, far from it, but that was, you know, they were paying me to do the managerial work, which I thought was something I could do better than just being an individual scientist in the lab. But I had my contacts with all these scientists. It was just, and then after I retired from Bell Labs, and I left with only the warmest of feelings, but I didn't have a warm feeling toward the U.S. government. I still don't. But then I developed all kinds of interesting contacts with other companies. And you know, before I knew it, I was working with the vice president of research at Schlumberger and at Eastman Kodak, and I was on the board of Roman Hawes, and a whole lot of things.
I understand you and Howie Simmons.
Yeah,
was that in his post-retirement period that you?
No, I'd known him before, and I was never a consultant for him, but I just happened to know him. From, a lot of them I knew from the Industrial Research Institute,
okay.
But in the chemical industry, the person that the place that I had the most contacts with was the Roman Hawes Company. But I joined their board soon after I retired. In fact, I guess I joined it before I retired, and then they asked me to be a consultant in addition, and I helped lure Bob Naylor away from DuPont and hire him as vice president of research. He was a terrific success. And also the Vince Gregory, who was, yes. You might know these people.
I met
Vince. Vince was the CEO, and he was a very forward-looking fellow, and he said, we've got to worry about environmental things and health, safety, and environment, and the board should do this. So he asked me, I was the only outsider who was a chemist by profession, so I was the chairman of the board committee on health, safety, and environment, and got some others in, and I brought in a couple of people from outside, Gil Ullman from the University of Washington, Dan Okun from North Carolina on water quality and so forth, contamination. So I spent an awful lot of time with the Roman Hawes people. I got to know them very well and had great admiration for them. So I was a regular commuter to Philadelphia on one or the other of these board meetings. Maybe there were 9 or 10 a year. My committee, because we'd have to meet all day, we couldn't just do it in an hour in the morning on board, and consulting with Bob Naylor, I'd go out and he and I would review the work of all of his research people. So, you know, this was just fun, pure fun.
Mm-hmm.
And they paid me to do it, you know. But I was... but other places, you know, there weren't conflicts. I mean, there was not any overlap of interest, just to take an example. The things I did for Jack Thomas at Eastman Kodak, they were really different. And I often got to know the CEO of these companies. I was consulting with Jack Thomas, and and met the CEO and the president of the company, who was later the CEO. Walter Fallon was the CEO, and Colby Chandler was the president. And they said, we want you to come and consult with us, because their problem was, how are we going to move from an era in which film is things like razor blades and razor, you know, and Gillette, film and cameras. They were giving away cameras to sell film. Mm-hmm. They said, when it becomes electronic and people start storing the images on tape, what are we going to do at Eastman Kodak? We're not. It's going to be hard in the film business. So they wanted consulting activity on, from my electronics background, you know, what, and so they were different areas to focus on. As I would say. And it was all fun. I learned so many different things from so many different things. I also spent a lot of time, probably Roman Haas and Atlantic Richfield were the two that I spent the most time with. Atlantic Richfield had been created by Bob Anderson, and he just merged other companies. He first got the Atlantic Refining and Richfield Oil Company. Later on, he brought in the Sinclair Oil Company, and they were all merged and so forth. And he was a nut on technology, so he was buying biotechnology companies and solar cells and everything. And when I was asked to chair an outside group that would advise them on science and technology, I think they had 17 different laboratories, and they wanted to rationalize this. So I got to know, you know, the petroleum business, and I had some geologists and other kinds of people in this committee, and a very distinguished group of people. And it was, I'm trying to convey a sense of having had worked a lot of hours in my retirement years, but having a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. To me, it was just a pleasure.
You've also done some economics work with Ralph Landau.
Oh yeah, Ralph is a. In fact, I just got a letter from Ralph. He was asking me why I had disappeared. Ralph and I. See, I was a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering. He was the National Academy of Engineering. I had agreed with Court Perkins, who was an aeronautical engineer, a professor at Princeton, was the president of it. And he asked me, wouldn't you like to be, I wasn't an engineer, but I sort of regarded myself as an applied scientist. Court said, how'd you like to be the foreign secretary of this? You know, they hadn't yet worked themselves up to having real elections. So I said, well, that's all right, you know, the foreign secretary. I thought that it would, I'd meet a lot of people from around the world and so on. Maybe I'd even get some foreign travel. Turned out that was a pain. But anyway, that, and Ralph, what the dickens was Ralph? Well, at one point he became the vice president of the NAE. But anyway, Ralph and I, I set up a committee for the National Research Council on innovation, industrial innovation, and what the U.S. government was doing to suppress it, to kill it, and so forth. And Ralph and I were kindred spirits on this. And we wrote some reports. We had a committee, anyway, or I was chairman of it, and Ralph was the noisiest participant. And we wrote some reports, which did affect U.S. policy, and which called attention to the inhibiting effects of regulations and antitrust and so forth. And also we decided we ought to analyze industries. So I picked a number of industries, and we got experts on those, just the usual NRC things. We produced a series of volumes and so forth. So anyway, I saw an awful lot of Ralph, because he was right in the thick of all of these things, although they were really my projects. And I like Ralph. He's I wouldn't want to see him every day because he would wear me out. But Ralph, if you know Ralph, he's right in the thick of things still. He got interested. He regards himself as an economist now, and he got a professorship at Stanford. I could kind of an unkind thing. By giving them enough money, you know, you could be a professor of economics there, or I could if we had the money to give them that. Ralph made a smashing success as a chemical engineer. He started off with an idea that really paid off. So he was a terrific innovator, and talks about innovation all the time, but he'd had this one great big success which produced a company that made a pile of money, which was his company. It was his pile. And I like Ralph, and he's got an enormous amount of energy, and he's still active in the NAE and all these things in Washington. I got sick of it after about 7 or 8 years. I didn't want anything more to do with him. Too discouraging.
I had sent you an agenda, and our time is running.
It's running
to the end, and we've covered virtually everything.
I hope we have, but I.
Let me just ask you about one thing. We haven't said scientific innovation in those terms, but I think we've covered that pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
What is important for the future vitality of chemical R&D? That's number 15 on that list.
Yeah. Well, I feel that.